Welcome, everyone, to the Perceptive Podcast here on Game Wisdom. I am Josh Beiser, the owner and lead writer. Join me this week, artist for Smugby Games and Game Wisdom site designer, Kenneth Olm.
Hey there.
And our returning guest, fan of the site, Orson Poirier.
Ah, thank you for bringing me back.
Yep, it's great to talk to everyone again. We are recording late Sunday night. We had a bit of scheduling issues over the weekend to try to get the podcast, but we're finally here, and I think we're ready to get casting.
Let's do this.
Mm-hmm.
Before we get going, as you know, we launched our Patreon campaign last week, and we are basically looking for donations to start making some improvements to the site. I want to do more in terms of video analysis and live interviews, and your donations can basically help us get there a lot quicker. So if you haven't done so already, you can check out the Patreon campaign from our little tracker on the front page, and I will have, again, another note in the podcast for it. So please check it out, and we can hopefully make things a lot better.
Yeah, I mean, just on the technical side, no, I want to make a more mobile-friendly version of the site, and also mobile-friendly for people with tablets, along with expanding things that connect more with the YouTube account and make us more, produce more of that kind of high quality content we want. You see a little taste of it in the Patreon video itself. We'll probably be explaining a lot of the concepts through, Kinect typography and visual aids like that to really drive home what we're trying to discuss and make it even more evident for people that want to see something more visual and visceral.
Yep. And I'm actually in the works of getting our first live podcast, which will be coming very soon. We're basically going to be playing the game with the developer, talking about the design and his choices while the game is playing, and that will be some more of the video content that we'll hopefully be able to do more of with your Patreon donations.
So, Patreon donation or not, if you guys could also check out our Facebook page, our Twitter page, follow us, like our Facebook page, any of that kind of stuff will to help our, get more awareness for the campaign and just put that a load. That would be really great. So really appreciate all the listeners to give Josh a hand in that.
Definitely. Any help that you can give, we would love it. And as I said, the money will be going towards making the site better. So if you like what we're doing now and want to see more of it and a higher quality, please donate anything you can.
Hooray! Yeah.
And
under the cast.
Yay, Patreon!
And there's our marketing plug for the cast. So let's get going with the actual discussion. So the news this week that I want to talk about is this interesting blog post that was put on Gamasutra. This was done by game developer Jeff Vogel, I think. Now, I asked both of you last night if you heard of him, and I think you both haven't. Is that right?
I did check out his website, which looked hilarious.
Jeff Vogel, for those who don't know, he runs Spireweb Software. It's a PC developer since 1994. Jeez. That's amazing right off the bat. And he's been basically making old school, or at the time anyway, computer RPGs. He has done the GeneForge series and several other. His basically claim to fame is that a lot of his games effectively carry the same art style. It's that very old sprite design. Pretty much if you played an RPG from like 1995 and below, you probably know that type of style. But where he makes up for is with the gameplay. He makes some very deep RPGs. A lot of choices. He's one of those developers that his games pretty much let you do what you want within the world. So you have like a quest, but then you can do whatever you want, morality, the whole deal. So he basically goes for the gameplay side of things as opposed to art, sound, and stuff like that. So the post that he was writing is pretty much his response to people complaining about mobile games. And it's kind of an interesting discussion. As we know, the mobile market has pretty much exploded with the rise of tablets and smartphones, and has become very lucrative for pretty much developers like EA, PopCap has done something, as well as little guys, making like Candy Crush, well, they're not exactly little anymore, but something like Flappy Bird has, made millions of dollars. And so it's definitely caused this divide between new developers and a lot of the old guard. And he definitely fits the old guard category, and he's not exactly happy with people complaining about mobile games. He feels that a lot of it could be one part envy, and one part people, looking down on the mobile market, saying, these aren't really games, these are, simple little match 3 stuff, there's no content there, you're just basically making something simple and making tons and tons of money off of it. And it's definitely a weird argument, especially for me, because I'm pretty much one of the old gamers as well. I've been playing since the Nintendo era, and I've seen us go from Nintendo to 3D to digital distribution. So it's kind of weird about how the mobile market has become this dominant force. So for both of you, what do you think about basically how the mobile games and the genre has really taken off and that whole debate?
Well, I mean, I could sense why he would be so kind of irritated by what's currently going on, because he's been doing it for so long and his games are pretty impressive. Like, even though I made a little jest at the website, the games themselves are just up my alley. Like, whenever I see those kind of games, I always like get really excited because they remind me of like the golden age of Western RPGs, at least in my regards. Like when Baldur's Gate and Icewind Dale. Specifically, Neverwinter was one of my favorite ones.
Now, I just want to stop you. He's not arguing against mobile games. He's arguing against people who are complaining about mobile games. So he's in support of the mobile market.
Right, right. Sorry. That's actually what I meant. What I'm saying is, with all those kind of games that he created, I think he really kept in mind the audience that he's kind of garnered. And I think he's seen how fickle people can be. So I think he's a bit jaded about his own, about gamers in general.
Yeah, now one interesting thing was, as one of the older school developers, he also resisted the whole sales, you know, Steam sales, stuff like that, for the longest time. And I remember it was such a big news when he finally decided to put his games on Steam, and then he put it on sale and he saw, you know, massive amounts of sales from that. I think he probably wrote another post about how much of a surprise that was for him.
That how successful the sales were?
Yeah. Like, as I said, he's been around since the days, you know, when games were $60, $70 a pop. So it's kind of weird now we're seeing games being released for, you know, $2, $3 sales. I mean, this whole week, and I think next week, Humble Bundle's running a spring sale. So we got, you know, $20 games for like a dollar.
Yeah, I mean, listen, I mean, these game creators want to sell their product.
Mm-hmm.
And especially when they've already reached the budget for their game itself, then they can easily put it on sale and still make a profit, because not only do they, again, want to make money, but they also want to show everyone or share their game with people, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the important part, is that they want people to experience what they've created.
Now, Lorson, do you play any, like, mobile games or any, like, the casual games that the Oracle was talking about?
I do not. I don't have a smartphone.
Yeah, me neither, so I don't feel too bad.
Yeah, I don't have like a tab. Like, the only thing I have is my computer, like my desktop and my laptop. That's it.
Now, one of the interesting points that he talked about is regarding how they're aimed for casual markets. And this is another one of those things which we'll probably talk about later on the cast, regarding pretty much how the marketplace has changed. We're seeing a lot more gamers, not just the more women playing video games and getting the game industry. We're seeing a lot of older people basically get into like a lot of the casual stuff, you know, Farmville, Candy Crush Saga, and so on. And this leads to a very interesting question. Games like Candy Crush and Farmville, which we know can be very exploitive in its design and its monetization, but people enjoy those games. So my question for the two of you is, do you feel that if these people enjoy these games, is it alright to make a game, you know, as monetized as Farmville? Or you think there is like some kind of ethical dilemma there?
Well, a game like Farmville, again, it's exploitative in a negative way, because they're going for the fast cash grab. You know, they know that people are impulsive, and people are addicted to, you know, the way they designed it. So they know that they can make a profit off it, but people eventually tire. People have a limit to how much they spend, and they're really hurting the market for everyone else, along with giving a very bad name to the whole mobile market / casual market.
And don't forget free-to-play as well.
Free-to-play, definitely. So to me, Zynga is like the biggest enemy. They're the EA of the Facebook and mobile games, you know?
If they're the EA, what's King?
King? Well, they're not as big as Activision, so would they be the Ubisoft of like when they were evil?
Yeah.
Ubisoft is doing pretty good now, but at one point in time, they were also as bad as EA. So.
Yeah, I think that's another tagline, Lorson, you could give us for a box. Ubisoft, now better than EA.
Was almost as bad as EA.
That's painful to even admit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there was that glorious time when Ubisoft, I think, was considered worse than EA. When they were doing the whole Uplay, when you couldn't play the game unless you had an online connection. They made heavy use of Star Force. source for their DRM service, and they still use DRM. I talked about this on a previous cast, but I refuse to play Far Cry 3 because it forcibly installs Punkbuster whenever I try to run the game, even if I don't play it online.
Yeah, actually, the Ubisoft stuff actually messes with my Oculus Rift, which really annoys me. I'm like, what? So, I mean, there's some benefits to it. I like some of the concepts, like you can actually use your points to actually buy things like wallpapers and stuff. That's kind of neat. I actually like that idea. I wish that Xbox Live did it when it first came out. But again, it's just another intrusive DRM service. It's its equivalent. I don't know why I like it more than Origin, but I still hate them both. And if I could get rid of them and just use Steam, I would.
Yep.
And I still
regret having... All right, now we're turning on to the hate EA train. We're about to get so derailed here so fast.
Well, I'm not derailing it. I'm just quickly saying that these people that try to put these services and people that argue that, well, you know, the competition's good, I don't think they're really competing against them. I just think they're just adding a new wall.
Yeah, I think I agree with you. I think this is where I sort of disagree with the blog post, saying that these games don't do any harm, stuff like that. Because we've spoken to developers like Chris Gardner and Joe McDonough, who they were working on their free-to-play titles, and they've seen the bile that a lot of gamers throw at just the title of free-to-play these days. Because these people automatically assume anything free-to-play is, you know, Farmville, Candy Crush, whatever. So while these games are making lots of money and they are basically filling a niche, they are also doing harm to the larger game market.
Right, and... It's just so strange. Like, EA, again, I don't want to keep railing on them, but look what they did to Plants vs. Zombies, too. Like, what was the point of all that? All this paywall, all those microtrans? Like, did the audience want that? Did the audience react well to that?
No,
they still say it's successful, yeah, but the true fans of them, the core fan of it, they're long gone. They played it, they dropped it, and that's it. And don't even forget that they said that they would never put microtrans in that Garden Warfare game, and now it's actually put in back in there. So.
And don't forget Dungeon Keeper. That game
did
horrible. And the article brings up saying, you know, who cares? You know, they mess with a brand. But then again, I think a lot of people do care. I mean, we see a lot of fans pining for that Dungeon Keeper experience, and they were hoping that this was going to be that deal. And instead, we got just a very dumbed-down, monetized game that, you know, did nothing.
Well, look at SimCity. It was built to be monetized. They had all those DLC packs, all those X packs ready for it. And again, everything was to glorify a microtrans system.
Mm-hmm.
And they created one of the worst remakes. Or, yeah, it is a remake technically, right?
It's considered a sequel, I guess, quote unquote.
Sequel?
Yeah.
But it has the same name. What is this madness?
Don't ask me. I don't work for EA. I can't give you these answers.
Or do you?
Dun, dun, all right. Dun.
The twist. But I was going to say, but it's, I don't know, it's just bad when these companies see how exploitive, like, again, they said no harm, right? But EA saw how successful games like Farmville was and Candy Crush was, and they're jumping on the bandwagon and making all their games, if they can, have the same kind of systems.
Mm-hmm.
And that's pretty messed up. So not only hurting a bunch of, you know, simple casuals, but you're hurting a core market too. So just like in art, when you produce something, you can produce anything you want. You can create anything you want, but you also have to be ready for the criticism that comes with it. If you make something that's sensational, or sensationalist, is what I mean to say, that you're going to get backlash from it. And they know how controversial microtrans is, yet they still forcibly put it in their game. Because even though they burn some of their bridges, they still have a little bridge left.
And the fact that the 1 or 2% people who will spend the money on those microtrans will basically make up for all the people who don't. Or as we know, it's the whales.
Yeah, exactly. That's what they're counting on. But again, they're just burning. I know they're famous for burning down their IPs, but they're burning it down at a much faster pace.
All right. Let's move on, because we definitely got a lot to talk about. So do either of you have any other news you want to talk this week?
Nothing that Far Cry 4 was announced. Ta-da! That has a guy with, like, a very flamboyant-looking shirt. That's all I know about the game so far.
And what about you, Larson?
Oh, nothing but Far Cry.
Okay. In that case, let's move on to the games we've been playing, because I got a game that I really want to talk about. That this is going to be so much, it's going to be part of a second cast, possibly next week. And that is Hearthstone. Now, Hearthstone, for those of you who don't know, is the free-to-play collectible card game Blizzard has put out. It's got quite an interesting story from what I've been reading. and how the team basically got torn down, and I think it was left to like two guys to like finish the game, and they were able to do it, and it got so much success that Blizzard basically gave the guys more funding to work on the game. And Hearthstone is a very interesting collectible card game. Now, have either of you played CCGs before?
Does Magic count?
Yeah.
Then yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I played Yu-Gi-Oh!
I did a little bit of Yu-Gi-Oh! Back in the day, but didn't get too far in that. So Hearthstone is interesting both in its monetization and in the gameplay. So you choose a hero, one of the guys from the Warcraft universe, who I haven't played anything Warcraft in like 8 years, so I have no idea who any of these people are. And this person becomes essentially the personality of your deck. It determines what class-specific cards you can use, and each hero has a power that they can pretty much use once per turn. So Wizard can launch like a fireball, does one damage. Shaman creates like a random totem on the field, and so on. How the game works is each turn, your mana pool, which determines what cards you can play, increases by one. And it refills every turn. So there's no like resource allocation. Like, I can't save two mana this turn and have it impact me on turn three. And each turn, with the mana going up, it means you can play more cards and get more pretty much strong cards out on the field to a grand total of 10 mana for each side. And usually by then, both sides have their best cards out and so on. The trick of the game is that only one type of card can effectively block damage. It's minions who have the taunt ability. So all the other rounds, your guys are basically have free reign to attack the hero. When the hero runs out of health, you lose the match. It doesn't matter how many minions you have on the field, how many cards you have in your hand. Now here's where things get very tricky with Hearthstone, and this is where a lot of people have been debating whether or not it can be classified as pay to win or free to play. The cards have a rarity system like some of you would see in Diablo. So there's normal or common, rare, expert, elite, and legendary cards. You can have two copies of any card in your deck, which you have a 30 card limit. But you can only have one copy of a legendary card in your deck because they're, you know, the top tier type cards. Now, when you start going up the rarity, you're going to find that the cards not only grow in strength, but they'll have more utility compared to the common or the rare or uncommon. I forget the second tier rarity. So what that means is if I'm just using basic cards, someone who already has rare and elite cards are going to have a huge advantage. And from playing the game, it's not as simple as just saying, oh, this two-cost card and this two-card had, you know, 1 point of added attack. These cards do all kinds of unique abilities. Like, there's a one-cost card that basically gives everyone on the field the taunt ability, which means you can't target the other hero. And then there's cards that, you know, spawn minions. There's some that basically kill other guys immediately as soon as you place them down the field. And these are all the cards that you can basically get by spending money. The monetization works like this. Every time you win 3 games, you get 10 gold. And then there's daily quests that you can earn 40 gold a pop for. You can spend 100 gold to buy a booster pack that gives you 5 cards. Or you can play a sealed deck tournament to get a chance of getting more stuff. Now, any cards that you buy that you don't like, you can basically throw them out or disenchant them, as the game calls it, to get a resource called Arcane Dust, which when you have enough, you can use it to craft any card you want in the game. And I mean that any card that they have available, you can spend this dust and, you know, voila, it's now in your deck that you can add to your deck when you're playing the game. Now, the different rarity tiers have higher costs, so to craft a legendary costs 1,600 arcane dust. But if you're spending, you know, 50, 60 bucks on cards, you can easily just disenchant a bunch of cards and then get the one you want. And this is where things get very murky for me, because I've seen people, I know people who've done this, they basically go on, they find a popular deck strategy, and it tells you exactly what cards you need and how much it costs, and then they just spend the money, get the cards, and they have this killer deck. And that is a huge deal when you're playing against someone who's not spending money, and they're basically going by the luck of these booster packs. So here's the question I have for both of you. Now that you've heard that monetization model, do you consider Hearthstone to be pay to win in your eyes, or not?
Okay, Yeah, like I definitely do. To me, it seems, or okay, well, maybe I don't necessarily see it as pay to win, but I definitely see it as a cheap tactic.
Mm-hmm.
Just even hearing that, that brings me back. That reminds me of something I read, I think, about 3 years ago now.
Mm-hmm.
And it had to do with the South Korea free-to-play market.
Mm-hmm.
And how there was a collectible card game, but the only way you could get more cards is by paying. And I think like a 10 or a 12-year-old ended up racking a $10,000 phone bill on the credit card bill. And the parents were like completely outraged. And it was equivalent to 10,000 USD. And like, for me, this is what this kind of sounds like. I mean, I'm pretty sure a parent would keep a closer eye
mm-hmm.
on their kid that after what that happened. But to me, it just seems like seems very money grabby.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe not necessarily a pay to win, but I don't really think that it's a good tactic in a game.
What about you, Ken? What do you think?
I think it encourages a play in play to win or pay to win. Sorry. But I think it's still a free-to-play system,
mm-hmm.
and it's really up to your choice to do that kind of thing. And I guess it does give you that kind of advantage, so it's definitely 50-50. I mean, someone could just grind time away and still get that same amount of cards, too, if they wanted to do it that way, too.
So, yeah, I mean, you can get, I think, 2 or 3 quests a day, and they can be worth about 40 gold apiece, and a 1 booster pack costs, I think, 100 gold. So you do all 3 quests a day, that'll get you 120 gold. You can spend 100 of that on a booster pack. That'll get you cards, which you can either adopt into your decks, or you can disenchant them and use the arcane dust. But the part that I find that the more it annoys me, is the fact that when you're crafting, you choose whatever the hell card you want, and you can have that. To me, that just ruins a lot of the mystique or the thrill of playing a CCG game, is getting a random card and seeing how that will fit into your deck. Because as I said, there are pretty much deck strategies online that anyone with enough money can follow and have a deck that, you know, will absolutely kill someone who's just been putting something together basically patchwork style.
Well, isn't that the same kind of problem with Magic and stuff like that? So there's a lot of different kinds of exploits
mm-hmm.
in deck preferences. But there is a certain level of luck with the draw, but in the end of the day, you still have a superpowered deck. But what you were saying earlier about what kind of unnerves you about, you know, getting any cards you want, mm-hmm. I think, and it's going to sound, you know, more hate, again, I don't know if it sounds more hateful, but mm-hmm. Diablo 3's shop system.
You mean the auction house?
The auction house kind of like destroyed Diablo 3 when it first started, because the glory, one of the best things about that game is just finding random equipment and finding awesome loot and sharing with your friends or bragging about it to your friends. And when you take that mystery away, that chance, that,
mm-hmm.
you know, the wonder of finding a special item, I think that takes some of that magic away and I think hurts the game overall.
You lose a lot of the motivation to play when you can just say, you know, I'll just spend $10 and get a really good weapon, or in Hearthstone, I'll just spend, you know, $50, get all that dust, and then I'll craft these 3 cards I need for this strategy.
Yeah, it's interesting. With League of Legends, there's something called mystery gifting,
mm-hmm.
where you can mystery gift someone a skin mm-hmm. for, like, I don't know, 400 RP, which is equivalent to, like, $4 or something. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you have a chance to get a legendary skin out of it.
Mm-hmm.
So they could either get, like, a legendary skin or one of those really old skins.
Yeah.
But the chance is still there, and there's still a sense of wonder to it. And it's addictive in its own right. But this one, saying that as long as you spend enough money, you can just make the card,
mm-hmm.
and that's it, then why not just have a system where you can just buy the card?
Yeah. Or I think that's what they're doing, is you have to basically buy it, and then if you get a really good rarity level, but it's a card you don't like, you can disenchant for, you know, 400 or 500 arcane dust, and you can use that towards something else. And,
right.
And the thing that annoys me is that there's no separating between the haves and the have-nots. I'll give you an example. I was playing a game last week. The rank system goes from 25 to 1. So the higher you are, the more new or the weaker you are. So I was fighting another rank 23 person who was using a priest deck. And I was watching him, and for 8 turns in a row, every card he played was pretty much either a healing, a shield, or a taunt. Pretty much anything that was associated to a priest. And this was all part of this one strategy I was pretty much watching. He was just following this one strategy revolving healing and buffing this one character, and I couldn't do a damn thing about it. And I realized that either this person was the luckiest SOP in the world in terms of the booster packs, or he spent a lot of money got every card exactly according to a deck strategy, and now he's just going through the motions of this one strategy or this one type of build to win. And there really wasn't anything I could do because I was still using, you know, my patchwork deck of, you know, random cards I started with.
I think that's very irritating, too, just because you know that there has to be, when you play multiplayer games, there has to be a certain sense of fairness mm-hmm. when it comes to competition. And when you take that away, or at least having that kind of knowledge mm-hmm. that this is what they did, it really kind of sours the experience and detracts a lot of people. I think that's definitely an issue.
Yep, and as I said, I'm losing a lot of the motivation to keep playing because either I'm going to have to spend money or get really lucky. And a lot of the high-level play, because this is a system of hard rules, it's very easy to find optimal deck strategies. But in a game like Magic the Gatherer or Yu-Gi-Oh!, it's not like you can exactly get those cards you need. You know, you're always going to get a random luck of the draw when you buy a pack. But here, because you can basically buy whatever cards you want, it makes it so much easier to just say, you know what, I'm just going to follow this pro player's deck. I got, you know, $200 to spend. Let me just throw it all here and I'll have a, you know, a number one deck in minutes.
Right. And again, when you can do that, doesn't that kind of suck the fun out of the game itself?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, it's there's no better than just playing against another computer if you want to stop somebody.
It just becomes, you know, who can complete their awesome deck strategy first. So it's not really you're playing the game. You're just going through the motions of, you know, this deck is built around this strategy. Let me just do this over and over again.
Right.
And I want to talk more about Hearthstone, but we're going to be doing a couple card game related cast soon. So I'm going to save a lot more of that discussion for then. So let's move on. And Ken, what game have you been playing?
So I finished Tesla Effect, which is actually pretty decent. It was longer than I expected because a lot of the Kickstarter games are pretty short because their budget was so small. Mm-hmm. But in this case, they had a lot of different scenes. It was pretty funny, a lot of throwbacks. I mean, again, the issue was just they didn't really do that much work on the environments mm-hmm. as much. And especially some of the textures were really lazy.
Mm-hmm.
But the video work was excellent. It was still campy, but it was 2K or 4K. Resolution to look really, really nice, and I think the acting and the writing was pretty spot on to what I expected. And there's a cornball factor to it, but I still really enjoyed it. And I think that it left it open for more to the series. I'm glad, and I hope that there will be more. It's just sad that I didn't see it at the top seller for Steam. It just kind of disappeared. It mm-hmm. was there, and then it was gone,
mm-hmm.
which is tragic. But they did make their money back on their budget because they did have a Kickstarter, so that's good.
Yep.
And there's people like me who saw a very, like, it's an FMV game. Like, when do you see that anymore?
Mm-hmm.
So when I would see games like that, I immediately buy it. And I think I'm actually happier that I bought Tesla Effect over Child of Light.
Yeah. We talked about that last week, I think, with Rob. Child of Light's been getting some mixed reviews. A lot of people don't exactly like how the gameplay evolved. You know, Rob got really annoyed by that rhyming system, which would probably drive me nuts as well. Morrison, do you like when people basically just rhyme all the time, like the old, you know, children's tales?
I think it's funny for about the first two lines, and then I get highly annoyed afterwards.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's where me and Rob were at with that. So playing an entire game where they do nothing but rhyming, I think that may drive me over the edge.
I think it would be pretty crass if you kept doing that during our cast. See, after a line or two, I think we'll probably turn blue.
Mm-hmm. See, I'm horrible at rhyming, so it would take me like an hour to come up with just that rhyme right there.
Yeah, you'd be like, oh, it takes me an hour to make this rhyme, so I have to make some, darn it. That'd be pretty much what you would do. But honestly, though, I think that with the rhyming thing, too, I think it's clever, but he said all the characters did it.
Mm-hmm.
Is that what he said?
Yeah.
That's too much. If it was just one character, that's fine. Because then you have the option to talk to them and everything. But if everyone kind of goes around forcing rhymes, because not everything rhymes, right?
Mm-hmm.
But hey, if the writer did that, applause to them. That's a lot of thinking involved
mm-hmm.
to make all your lines rhyme. But it does follow the motif of the game, storybook.
Yeah.
You know? So I think that's smart and tragic at the same time.
And you also play The Walking Dead, I think, too, right?
Yes, I just finished Walking Dead Season 2, Episode 3. Which actually had some mixed reviews on it.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was the best of the three. People said it was the worst of the three.
Mm.
And game trailers get a 6.5.
Ooh.
And they gave it, I don't know why they get such a low rating, because, example, they said that Clem didn't really react to things that she was seeing. But to me, she didn't react to things Yashin because she was becoming more hard of a person. She's already seen a lot of crap. Mm. And she's seeing more stuff, and she knows how she should, you know, act. And I think that also in the episode two, everyone relies on her a lot more because she is so skilled, useful, and people underestimate her. So I think that was great, but they said that there's a lack of character development, and then you got to do everything. And I'm like, yes, because to me it fits within the group, at least if you look at the group itself. So I see that. I like where it's going. I thought it was a good resolution. I think that there's a lot of drama involved, and it leaves on a pretty gigantic cliffhanger. So I really enjoyed the third one, but everyone keeps saying that it's worse because of, you know, them working on so many games at once. Four games, right? What? Tales of Borderlands, Wolf Among Us, and the Game of Thrones game.
Mm-hmm.
So they said that there's a big split too thin, and the writers can't keep up, and the quality is diminishing.
Yeah, people were saying that about the Wolf Among Us episode 2, and how it was just really short. It, you know, had nothing to do with what part 1 alluded to, and it just felt really, like, except for like one scene, like the whole thing could have just been skipped over.
Right. So I feel like people said that it felt like they were spinning in circles in that episode. Here, I think there was actually progress, and I think that a lot of the harsh criticism were a little unwarranted, I would say. I don't really think it's them. I just don't think that, like, okay, so the main antagonist, you didn't see his human side as much, but I don't think you needed to, right? You don't always have to do that. And in this aspect, it's a character who was really built up in the first two episodes. So I think that's why people didn't like how the problem was dealt with.
Mm-hmm. Did you play any of the Wolf Among Us yet, Ken?
No, for that series, I'm actually going to wait. Mm-hmm. For Walking Dead, I can't wait. I need to play those.
And I'm the opposite. I've been waiting on Walking Dead, and I've been playing every episode of The Wolf Among Us.
Good, we can trade notes then.
Good. Lorson, have you played either Wolf Among Us or Walking Dead yet?
Nope.
What a mistake.
I don't know. Last adventure game I played really, really hurt me. Hurt me bad. It left scars on my heart.
Blackwell?
Jurassic Park.
That one was terrible. That was, why
I know.
You didn't get it? It reviewed so terribly.
Because Jurassic Park was, until Pacific Rim, my absolute favorite movie in the world. And I was like, oh yay, a new game! And no, it abused me very hard.
I think we said this on a previous cast, but if you haven't checked out the Blackwell series, both Ken and I really enjoy that. The puzzle design, I think, was really great. Has a strong storytelling. And the series is wrapped up now, so it doesn't look like there's going to be another one.
Yeah, I just started that too, and it definitely is very good, even though I'm not very good at it.
It's okay. You'll get stuck on puzzles. I also get stuck on the puzzles. Even after playing all of the original four in the finale, I still couldn't do puzzles. I got stuck. And I couldn't look for tips because it just came out. I'm like, no, I'll have to figure it out with my brain.
And also, when you're done playing, you do have to play through again with the commentary on. Especially with the last chapter, it's just hilarious, some of the things they say as bloopers or jokes on there.
Though, we did find out that there's a room in the Shiva, which is also the same room in the Blackwell Epiphany, which is something we'll probably talk to him about if he ever comes back on the cast. But yeah, I should probably play all this game with commentary.
Mm-hmm. So with that, let's move on. Lorson, what game have you been playing this week?
I've been playing a free-to-play game called Arena, and it's like A-E, like the Greek letter Arena, and it's kind of interesting. It's a, like, you are a pilot of a ship, I guess, like that's like your home base, and it has like health points, and the point of the game is to get the other person's ship to zero while staying alive. You have, at a time, you're against one other person, and you both are given three characters to use to attack the other ship, and then you're given, they're called something, but I just call them magic coins, even though that's not what they're called, but they're like power-ups that when you gain enough ether, that you use them, you use up your ether, and you can use them as a special attack. Like, one of them is spend 4 ether, you do 3 damage to a champion on the screen, spend 8 ether, do 3 points of direct damage against the other ship, spend 10, and you can do 3 points of damage to all the other champions on the field, But it's turn-based, so, like, I'll put a character on the field, I'll put a character on the field, and you do that for the first 6 turns, and then when it's your turn again, then you, like, move them around and Some of them have like special abilities. Like one of them has like a javelin that when it has enough ether, she can shoot through, I think, like two or three squares and do 2 points of damage to each champion as long as they're like right one behind the other.
Mm-hmm.
Another one can shoot a super long distance, which can be really useful when you don't have enough space to move up and then attack. And another one has one where you can blow back people, and that's really important because, as I said, you're on a ship and you're in an arena that's like above the ground. So when you blow back people, you kick off other champions off the edge,
mm-hmm.
and then the ship will take, I think, a point of damage. It might be two. So you can bring down the person's ship either by directly attacking them or killing their champions or knocking them off.
Mm-hmm.
It's rather fun. It's tier based, so you start off in bronze, and then there's silver, gold, platinum, then diamond. And I played it, I think, the first day, so this kind of complaint's gonna be maybe a little bit weird, but I went up to silver after only winning 3 matches,
mm-hmm.
and after that, it was like literally the scale greatly increased in difficulty. Like this one guy, I think I was only able to do like 2 points of damage against him, and then he completely drained me. Something like that. And so there's no way to go back down after that. Once you're up a tier, I don't think it's possible to go back down to bronze.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm now permanently stuck in silver, even though I only played the game for like 2 hours one night.
Mm-hmm.
Stuff like that. Also, I think you can buy stuff in the game, like with actual money, and I don't know how to do that because it's the system's a little bit confusing.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, besides that, it's kind of fun.
Okay.
Sort of.
Is the general gameplay, is it more like of a CCG game, like you place characters down like as cards, or is it like a turn-based strategy? Like you can like move guys around like the board or stuff like that.
It's a turn-based strategy, but when you have a turn, you only like. Like, if I put down character A, and then you put down character B, and then I put down character B and put down character A, my next turn, I can only move character A.
Okay.
So, whatever order you place them down, that's the order you can move them, but you can only move one champion at a time, and the other person's champion moves.
Mm-hmm.
So, I feel like if you start out, you're at a really big disadvantage if you start first, because then your other person can counter you.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, once you seal the champions down, like, I knew I was going to lose my one game in silver because I was like, there's no way I can counter this. And then, unfortunately, I did rather fast. So it's unique, and I'm pretty sure better players who have a better grasp of the game could definitely do a lot better than I did. But
okay. So you said that there is, like, you can buy, like, new champions. Is that, like, how it works in terms of monetize?
You can buy them with two types of currency. One of them is in-game, and then one of them is, like, dollars. I guess they're green. A lot of it's kind of confusing to read on the screen.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you can buy more of the green money, but you can also earn it in game just very slowly. But like I said, you can buy I think they're called containers, the little like power up chips. You can buy new champions, and you can buy new ships.
Do the ships have like any impact on playing the game?
Yeah, they change a bit. I never really looked into it because I just kept the basic ship. I think one of them, I don't think it necessarily gives you more health, but like it gains like ether faster,
uh-huh.
and just like little stuff like that. Like nothing, because if it gave you more health, and if you went against somebody who's say using the basic ship, that clearly put them at a really big disadvantage.
Okay, cool. All right, I know we're rushing through the cast this week, but as I said at the beginning, we are recording late Sunday night. So let's move on and talk about the topic of the week, and that has to do with the piece I wrote regarding video games as art. It's that ever-popular debate that usually someone writes some kind of blog post about every 2-3 months. The inspiration for the article came from what we talked about earlier with Child of Light. Now, Child of Light features a very strong visual aesthetic. We talk about the rhyme and how all this lends to this very storybook or childlike atmosphere. And a lot of reviews have been complaining about the gameplay. They've been giving it lower scores. And a lot of the defenders have been saying that you shouldn't grade too harshly because of the game's visual style or the game's, I guess, like the rhyme or pretty much the storybook aesthetic. And this is where that the debate over art games come from. Games such as Dear Esther, Gone Home, as I mentioned in the post, just about any game from Tale of Tales. And it's one of the things where I've gotten to the point where I don't feel that games that, even if they try to do something different in terms of storytelling, that you should just ignore issues with the gameplay, issues with controls, or whatever. And I think this is going to be an interesting debate, because I know Ken, who's an artist, looks at games a lot more from the aesthetic side than I do.
Aesthetic and design.
Mm-hmm.
So, like what you said about the Tower of Light, and people saying that it's immune to criticism, I don't really think that's the real argument at all. People know that's not true. Everything mm-hmm. is up for grabs, for criticism.
Mm-hmm.
And right now I'm criticizing that idea. Mm-hmm. So when you break a game down, or break anything down, you can always find a flaw. I mean, I just think that some people like certain games, and some people were kind of let down with what they expected from Tower of Light. But I still think it's respectable in terms of the aesthetic they put onto it. I think it has a great style.
Mm-hmm.
Atmosphere, I think they did a pretty good job with music. And they made it a little more involved than a regular RPG. So I think that's pretty cool. And they're definitely not like super indie, because what, they're published by Ubisoft.
They're an actual, I think, team within Ubisoft.
Ubisoft, right. And they're using the Rayman Legends engine,
mm-hmm.
which is why it got that kind of beautiful storybook look. But again, I don't think they're immune to criticism. And I think that anyone that ever uses that argument,
mm-hmm.
I don't think they... I just think they're very immature, because when you're trained as an artist, you're always getting critiqued. You're always, you know, submitting your work. You're always showing your work to someone else. And you're taught to kind of disconnect yourself with your work, because no one knows more the flaws of your work than yourself.
Mm-hmm.
You see it while the other person doesn't.
Yeah.
So you always try to keep a separation, because there's always going to be disappointment
mm-hmm.
when you show someone. It's always something that they dislike or want to be improved or fixed or anything. And I think that obviously goes with anything you create, including mm-hmm. games.
Yeah. Now, what do you think about the argument regarding games like Gone Home? We were talking about this the other night, how Gone Home was originally priced at $20 for only, I think the story's like maybe 2-3 hours long if you push it. And I know a lot of people complain about the length, saying, you know, why am I spending $20 for 3 hours of play when I can buy another game maybe for $10 and maybe get 20-30 hours of play out of it?
Quality over quantity, right? Because mm-hmm. you can play a lot. There's a lot of games you can play out there for an infinite amount of hours. Look at Farmville.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that's a quality experience you'll remember? No.
Mm-hmm.
What they're trying to do is craft an experience. I think that's very important, that we have experienced games. And people say that just because you interact with it, it isn't a game. But people forget about the old point and clicks of those adventure games. Mm-hmm. Are you going to discredit all of those as non-games, because not Twitch-based?
Yeah.
I think that's really silly. I think that there should be a variety of genres. That's why it exists in the first place,
mm-hmm.
to create games like this.
And we talked about this last night, and how a lot of people, there's a lot of, you know, elite and, like, snooty people who look down on stuff like the Match 3 genre, the missing object genre, you know, saying, oh, it's not a game. Or, you know, I think you brought up, like, the Call of Duty people who, if it's not, you know, a first-person shooter, they don't see it as a game where it's worth their time.
Right. It's a baby game. It's a casual game. It's it's filthy casuals, except so, you know, all that kind of, like, trash talking.
Mm-hmm.
But what they're really saying is that I don't agree with this game type because it's not within my taste.
Mm-hmm.
But it's no reason for it not to be created. Mm-hmm. I think that's a good line to separate right there.
Yeah.
It's because I think anything is viable, because that's what we need. We always look for innovation.
Mm-hmm.
That's what people always ask for.
Mm-hmm.
They want different kinds of games. So when I see games like Tesla Effect, which is what, a full motion video game in 2014, that's ridiculously silly.
Mm-hmm.
I want to try it out. I want to experience something different. And same thing with Tower of Light.
Mm-hmm.
I want a new experience. I just don't want a reiteration of Call of Duty mm-hmm. or Madden or whatever. I want something that's going to bring me a new experience. It doesn't have to be through a narrative, just an experience.
Have you played any of the games from Tale of Tales yet?
Which ones did they make?
They made The Path, that Luxuria Superior game, a game, I think, The Cemetery or The Old Woman in the Cemetery. They make a lot of their games are just very unique. Some of them are maybe only like 20 minutes long.
I wanted The Path, actually. I still want The Path, because mm-hmm. it has cards to it, and I need to finish my collection. But it looked like it was a pretty interesting concept. But again, it's, I don't know, they're trying something artistic. They're being experimental. I don't think there's anything wrong with that.
Mm-hmm. Now, Orson, have you played any games like Gone Home, Dear Esther, or those games that tend to lend more towards narrative as opposed to gameplay?
I have not, mostly because it's just not something that mm-hmm. I I have, like, I mean, there was one game I was interested in, I think, is something about a grandfather in the moon, but...
Was that To the
Moon? To the Moon?
To the Moon, yeah, yeah, yeah. I saw, sorry, I couldn't remember what it was called. I remember seeing an ad for that, when it first came out, like, I think a demo before it was released, and I really wanted to play it, I just never got around to buying it.
Yeah, I think it's kind of interesting. I think for me, I'm similar to you, Ken, in that I can look at a game and get more value from it without needing fancy graphics or, you know, tons and tens and hundreds of hours of gameplay. But for me, instead of it being unique from an aesthetic side, I need something to hook me from a gameplay perspective. So something like The Binding of Isaac, which I think I have almost, I think just about 100 hours I spent playing that one game. We've got, you know, I got almost 1,000 hours playing Left 4 Dead. I know you're probably up there, or probably more than that with Team Fortress 2 by now.
Almost 3,000 hours.
I'm about 1,600.
Well,
oh, you're just a baby.
Me.
Just a baby.
You two just call me babies at the same time?
No.
No. He's the baby. He's an egg. You're a baby. And I'm like a regular adult, I guess.
I may be like a psycho.
Am I a teenager or am I a child?
You can be a teenager. I'll let you be rebellious. How's that? Then Josh is the baby then. You're just a baby, Josh.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But yeah, but I definitely agree. Like, I think that we both value quality, but we just do it in different kind of regards. I do it more towards the experience.
Mm-hmm.
You do it towards game mechanics.
Mm-hmm.
So things like Gone Home, I found delicious. Something I really wanted to get a sense of. And it was a story that I thought was really cool. I thought I haven't really seen it, and I really loved the voice work. It was very, very good. But people, like, simplify the story and just dismiss it so haphazardly. But if you can do that to almost any game you like.
Yeah.
You can easily just summarize sort of like, what? Batman, just a guy in a cape. Halo, just a guy in a suit, find aliens. I'm like, all right. You could, like, I don't know why you have to be so dismissive of the game just because it kind of is outside your boundaries, you know? Just, if you don't like it, just don't play it. But you don't have to insult all the audience or all the people that enjoy the game.
And I think this is going back to the argument from Jeff Vogt, what he was sort of arguing with people complaining about the free-to-play or the mobile market. And I think we agree with that dismissing mobile games, you know, just because they're mobile games, that's not right. But if they give a reason to do it, like exploit monetization, or they're trying to sucker you in, I think that's a different story. But just saying, you know, oh, I don't like playing Match 3 games, so all of them suck, and then you said that's just more dismissive. It's not a critical opinion.
Right, and my problem with mobile games has nothing to do with the design of them. It's actually more about the stores themselves. There's just not enough visibility.
Mm-hmm.
I can't find the quality ones over the crappy ones.
Yeah.
There's just so much trash that's on there. It's hard for me to find the really good mobile developers.
Yep, and we're seeing a similar problem with Steam now that Early Access and Greenlight are now showing up on the front page, that it's very hard to see a brand new game and go, oh, wait, it's Early Access, so it's not going to be done for another year or two.
Right. Poor Tesla effect.
Mm-hmm.
It was there one day and then gone the next. Why?
Yep. So,
that's a tragedy.
Same thing happened with The Last Federation. I think I don't even see it on the front page anymore. It's already been kicked off. Dark Souls 2 is still on there. But yeah, it's fleeting these days on getting store viability. I've spoken with a mobile developer, I think, I forget his name again, which will come to me later. But he talked about how with the mobile market, you pretty much have a day, maybe 2 days top on the front page. Doesn't matter if you just released, you know, the biggest epic mobile game ever made or a simple, you know, Flappy Bird clone. You have maybe a day, 2 days tops for people to see it, and then it just gets buried and buried underneath all the other releases that are coming out.
Right. So again, it's, you have to, like, when you launch, you better be prepared to do your PR blitz because it's going to come and go like crazy. And again, it's harder and harder, and hopefully they'll never become as bad as the Play Store. That's god-awful.
Mm.
And even the Amazon App Store is really bad.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I mean, actually, I wouldn't say the Play Store. Actually, I find that the Amazon App Store is actually worse than the Play Store.
Mm. I have a post I'm finishing up, a series where I'm looking at common mistakes that indie developers make, and one of them is PR. We see a lot of developers either go completely dark, you know, they don't say anything for 2-3 years and they just release the game, or they'll release the game and then they won't do anything like Steam related. They'll, you know, avoid trading cards or achievements, stuff like that, which it's on principle, they want their game to shine brightly, which you can't fault them for. But in today's market, when you've got dozens of games vying for your attention, you know, saying, hey, we got Steam trading cards or achievements, you do have to kind of play the game a little bit in order to get your game sold.
But the cards are so easy to make. Mm-hmm. You have concept art. Just put it in like a rectangle and done. Done and done. You made it.
Yeah.
And then no matter if your game's good or bad, someone's going to buy it because they want to finish a collection. All the collections.
Yep. It adds value to the game even if you don't see it. And remember when we spoke with Keith Nemitz from Mouse Chief about it and how they said, hey, would you like to get into our Steam trading card program? He's like, nah, I don't think it's going to do that well. And
what a mistake.
He saw what happened there.
He told us like he regretted not doing that because he had some friends that did gangbusters with the cards that increased their sales by like 400%.
Yeah.
I'm like, whoa, cards.
And I mean, how many games have you bought because of trading cards?
If I see a game for a dollar, I'll buy it just for the cards. Because usually I can sell the cards for more than the game's worth at that point if it's a dollar.
And I still can make crap for my trading cards.
Oh man, sometimes I get booster packs. I just sold a car for a dollar.
Of course you did.
It's because the rare the game is, like the less people have the game.
Mm-hmm.
Like example, like the Path, those cards are worth at least 35 cents minimum. With like a regular card going for like $1.20 or something. So go buy the Path.
I already have it. I think I may have just stole it and play.
Quick, go get it and give me your cards.
Of course. Who didn't see that coming?
I need to finish my sets.
And you got.
I was wondering when he was going to start asking for cards.
Yeah, we almost got the entire cast. You got to give me your Blackwell cards.
Maybe. You have to trade me other cards for them. Can't come out unscathed. Haggle.
This is what we've come to now in the podcast. We should just turn the podcast into a trading hour.
Yeah, we should have a trading hour podcast. Yeah, no, a live stream.
Mm-hmm.
We'll bring in fans. We're like, hey, you want to trade some cards? Do this for this.
Mm-hmm.
First live podcast has to be dedicated to Ken trying to steal everybody's card.
Mm-hmm.
It'll be a game, our meta game.
That's what your patron dollars are going for, people, right there.
You're welcome. Me trying to cheat you out of your cards. Mm-hmm. I mean, haggle you for your cards.
Mm-hmm.
But back to what we were talking about with art and games. But again, just because a game is simple or a game is outside your taste or it's outside your comfort zone doesn't mean you have to rip it apart just for existing. I think there's an audience for any type of game out there. And I think that when people dismiss games like that, you know, the match threes and the fine games, I think that it's just being very narrow-minded. And if you really love games, you want to share as many people as possible.
Yep. And just one last question for the two of you, and then we'll wrap things up. And this goes back to what I was talking about on the post regarding people who feel that their games are, I'm trying to think of the most political way of saying it. Like people who believe that, oh, I just want to make games. I don't care about selling them. I don't care about piracy. As long as I keep making the games I want, you know, everything is fine and dandy. And this is where I kind of see problems with people moving from being an enthusiast to a designer. And as we've talked about on this cast and with a lot of other developers, when you take that step to becoming a professional game developer, you do have to put on your marketing hat, I feel. You do have to sell your game. You do have to look at things in the bigger picture. So I'm just wondering, Ken Lorson, what do you think about that, or about people who feel that, you know, as long as I make my game and, you know, I don't care about anything else?
You first?
Me first?
Mm-hmm.
Well, personally, I think that's great.
Mm-hmm.
Why not? If they're passionate, like, I'm always about people following their dreams. And I mean, if they want to go from being, like, a hobbyist to fully on, like, I don't really care about what other people think. Like, I think I can make a good game and I think it'd be good like this. Art, mobile, you know what? Go for it.
Okay.
For me, I would say that there's a limit. Because if you really want to do it as an occupation, something that you want to continue doing, then you can't put it up for piracy. You can't put it up for free. Mm-hmm. You need some way to monetize your game. If that's your full-time job, then that's what you're going to have to do.
Yeah.
But you can still have passion and make a profit.
Mm-hmm.
But again, don't let profit blind you. Mm-hmm. Don't become EA. Don't become those kind of companies that make everything microtrans.
Mm-hmm.
Just make a decent game and offer a decent price.
And as long as you make a quality game and you do at least some steps towards marketing it, you know, interviews, asking people to review, whatever, you know, as long as you're at least doing some kind of marketing for it, you don't have to spend millions of dollars on TV commercials, you can still make a living and make the games you want. And we have seen that time and time again with the indie market, and how a lot of these developers are making the games they want, but they're still doing the marketing side of it. When I spoke to Chris Park, he talked about how they plan their releases around, you know, the seasons and the sales. They don't just release a game when it's done. They make sure they release at the best time for them.
Right. And don't forget, guys, cards. Put cards in your games. Mm-hmm. Do it now.
Or TF2 hats.
Tesla didn't put cards in their games. That's the worst part of that game.
You better email about that.
I want to. I want my cards. I want the whole set right now on my desk. Print them and give it to me.
All right. So with that, I think we're going to wrap things up. I know this is a pretty quick cast, but as I said, it's getting late here, and we all got some things to do tonight. So, as always, Ken Larson, it was great talking to you tonight.
Yeah, no problem.
Thanks for inviting us.
And hopefully we can get together again soon. I know Larson and I have been playing a little bit of Payday 2 together.
Oh, please. Let's not talk about it right now.
And as always, for those of you listening, if you'd like to contribute to Game Wisdom, either by writing a piece or by appearing on a future podcast, you can send me an email under Submissions Wanted on the front page. That will take you to the guidelines as well as my email address. And again, please check out our Patreon site. You can find the link basically on our front page. You can click on our little thanks bar Ken made that shows our progress or what little we have right now, and check it out.
And like our Facebook page, and follow us Twitter and Google Hangout, Google Plus. Mm-hmm. Any of those social things can definitely help.
Mm-hmm. And as I said, look forward to possibly a live cast either this week coming up or next week. We are still getting the details, but it should be a very interesting discussion. So with that said, thanks for tuning into the Perceptive Podcast. Have a great rest of the week, and we will talk to you again next time. Take care.
Night.